For more than three decades, Sean Stroob has lived with HIV. He's lost hundreds of friends and acquaintances to AIDS and worked hard to make the world a better place for men and women living with this disease. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Sean Stroob grew up in Iowa City, but he came of age in the political world of Washington, D.C. and in New York City. He's an activist, a writer, and the founder of the Sero Project, which combats the criminalization of people with HIV. I'll talk to him about his life, his work, and his new book, Body Counts, a memoir of politics, sex, AIDS, and survival. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Sean Stroob has had a distinguished career as a gay rights activist and, in particular, an advocate for people who are living with HIV and AIDS. He founded Pause Magazine, designed to serve that community, and it's a community he knows very well since he himself has been living with HIV since around 1980. Sean grew up in Iowa City, and he has written about his remarkable life and career in the new book, Body Counts, a memoir of politics, sex, AIDS, and survival. And he is here with me now. Thank you so much for being here, Sean.
Very glad to be here. Thank you.
And I know you grew up in Iowa City. You grew up, you became very interested in politics. You went off to be a page in the Senate at the Iowa State House, and that also ended up, your interest in politics ended up taking you to Washington, D.C. What were your hopes and dreams as a teenager when you thought about your political career?
I didn't think about it far into the future. I didn't really think about a future a lot. Sort of in general terms, I thought I was supposed to be successful. I was supposed to go to college. But I think that as, you know, a gay person, not even understanding I was a gay person, but it sort of precluded me from sort of having much of a vision of my future because I didn't see anyone like me represented in any of the institutions or cultural context I grew up in. But politics was very immediate. It was now. It was very exciting. I was a news junkie at an early age, and it was so, you know, tied to what was going on in the media that I think that attracted my interest, as well as the sort of sense of sort of commitment to social change that I absorbed, you know, growing up so near the campus.
Now, of course, growing up, you grew up in a strong Catholic family, and your parents were conservative. And when you went off to work in the State House in Iowa, you chose not to align yourself with one party or another. So you had a lot of family background that put you in a difficult position as a young gay man trying to come to terms with what it meant to be gay, but also really taking a departure from your family politics as well.
Right. Well, my parents weren't especially political. I mean, I think their Catholic faith was more important than any political ideology. But I was so skeptical and distrustful of political institutions. You know, I mean, I was a child of the Watergate era and of Vietnam, and, you know, everything I knew about national politics led me to distrust partisan politics as a kid. So when I wanted to be a page, they required that the application, you had your county, you know, party chairman, chairperson sign the application and to get letters of recommendation. So I went to the Republican county chairperson, then I went to the Democratic county chairperson. I went to Ed Mazvinsky, who was an incumbent member of Congress at the time, and Jim Leach, who was running against him at the time. And I remember Minette Doder, who was the state senator from Iowa City and one of Iowa's most important feminists of the really of the ever. I knew Minette because I'd see her at auctions. We both liked to go into, you know, to auctions, farm auctions, and, you know, and so I started asking her about being a page, and she knew me from this kind of conservative Catholic family, and at the time, you know, choice issues were you know, incredibly important then as they were now, and finally, she sort of scribbled out a recommendation for me on a piece of her letterhead, and I think it was against her better judgment because she said something like, "Oh, you'll probably grow up and vote against me."
When you went to Washington, D.C., you had really chosen to focus on politics and on your possible career in politics in a way almost to avoid the subject of sexuality. As you know, so many of us when we're teenagers, obviously that's a time of a lot of discovery, and you really didn't feel like you had something that you could explore. You just weren't familiar with other people who were gay and didn't have a community to turn to. It strikes me that spending time in the Capitol in Washington, D.C. is a very strange place to start to learn about your sexuality.
It is. I mean, when I arrived in Washington, it was spring of 1976. So it was just past Watergate and the constitutional crisis that it engendered. It was just past the end of the Vietnam War that was so incredibly divisive. It was the bicentennial year. So everywhere in Washington was plastered with the bicentennial logo. And there was a lot of excitement coming up to the bicentennial. And Jimmy Carter was running for president, promising, "I will never lie to you," a novel concept in national politics at the time. It kind of fed into this idealism I had. But and as a political junkie working in the Senate, running an elevator that, you know, for senators only was like getting a contact high every day. But I think I had initially sort of substituted political ambition for political purpose. I had been exposed to all sorts of social change movements growing up, certainly the anti-war protests and to a lesser extent civil rights protests, to a very great extent feminism. That was like a part of me, but I almost disconnected that from the ambition I took with me to Washington. And then, you know, coming to Washington and starting to deal with, you know, understanding I was attracted to men and coping with that and the Catholicism and all that, while every day being in the presence of, you know, some of the most powerful men in the country, in the world, was I think, probably a fairly unusual coming out experience.
And as you started to figure out who else that you were in contact with was also gay, this is an area where people were even more deeply closeted than in other areas.
Right. The first gay men I met were other men who were also working very, very, very close to the you know, concentrations of political power in the country. You know, very senior officials with both parties. At that time, there wasn't an ideological divide socially amongst the closeted gay circles in Washington. Initially, I met no lesbians. It was only gay men, almost entirely white gay men. And what their political ideology didn't matter. You'd go to a party and, you know, there'd be, you know, these extreme right wingers who by day were spewing, you know, anti-gay, homophobic, you know, nonsense. But in the evening, they were socializing privately in great secrecy with people on the left. And as I started to come out and, you know, got to know this circle and became part of it, I also started reading the Washington Blade, a gay paper in Washington, and becoming more conscious of this gay rights movement that was then kind of at the edge of the body politic, not taken seriously by most of the you know, central players in our national political process. But it was there, and I was aware of it. And as I started to follow it more, the disconnect between the milieu I came out into and this political movement that I was felt so drawn to started to grow.
You spent a couple of years at Georgetown University, and then you transferred to Columbia. You went up to New York City, and you had been visiting New York City quite a bit. And the gay community in New York City was very different from the gay community in Washington, D.C. What was it that you saw in New York and experienced in New York that made you want to be a part of it?
There was a gay community in Washington that was out. This was very small. It was very much a part from the gay circles I became familiar with when I came out. And it was, you know, I said it wasn't taken seriously. In New York, I was meeting all these out gay people who were like totally integrated into, you know, their professions, their careers, their, you know, they sort of didn't care who knew they were gay. And that was very exciting to me, including some of the political people. You know, Ethan Ghetto, who ran the campaign against Anita Bryant when Anita Bryant ran the Save Our Children campaign to overturn the Dade County, Florida Human Rights Ordinance in 1977. Ethan worked for Bob Abrams, who was the Bronx Borough President and later Attorney General of New York, and he was his top assistant. He took a leave of absence to go to Florida to run this campaign against Anita Bryant as an openly gay man, and that was a revelation to me. That was something I couldn't have imagined in the circles I was in Washington.
What made you start to feel like maybe you could be honest about who you were and come out?
I think it was stages. You know, the first was actually meeting people who were very closeted and led functional lives, still had their careers. You know, the mantra was to keep your private life private. You know, it was about maintaining this secrecy that you could have this social life. That was an initial step. Then I kind of got to a point where I thought it was going to come out eventually, and so I stopped worrying about it as much. And then finally, I couldn't deal with the sense of dishonesty and not being authentic with people I cared about, and my family and my siblings and others. And so then I took steps to come out more formally. And it also became, you know, it's not a single step. It's a process for anybody, I think, even today. But it feeds on itself. You know, I got, I felt freer and more comfortable with myself. I started to have closer friendships. And also, just as an aside, I spoke in California a week or two ago and with a group of people, and we got into a discussion about coming out, and people were sharing their coming out stories, as LGBT people often do with each other. And there was a young person there who was maybe 23 or 24 years old. He was just listening. He didn't say anything. And finally, he started to speak, and he said, you know, I hear all of you talking about your coming out stories and how the difficulty and the drama and the tears and the angst and he said, for me, it wasn't like that. He said, coming out isn't the right word for me, right phrase for me. It was more about letting others in. And I was just so struck by that, that he was totally cool with it, you know, and it was a matter of judiciously deciding to let other people into his life.
I'm talking with Sean Strube. He is the author of a new memoir called Body Counts, a memoir of politics, sex, AIDS, and survival. He grew up in Iowa City and has had a distinguished career as a gay rights activist and an advocate for people who are living with HIV and AIDS. He's the founder of Pause Magazine. And he'll be speaking tonight at CSPS in Cedar Rapids at 5:30, followed by a book signing at Nubo Books. He'll also be reading Friday night at 7 o'clock at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City. And we'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me today is Sean Strube, and he has just written about his life in the new book, Body Counts, a memoir of politics, sex, AIDS, and survival. He'll be speaking tonight in Cedar Rapids at CSPS at 5:30. He'll also be reading on Friday night at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City. He grew up in Iowa City, but quickly, shortly after high school, left the state, went to Washington, D.C., and then from there to New York City. And just before the break, we were talking about coming out and living as an openly gay man at a time that is very different from today. And can you put in perspective for us, for people who don't know about the politics of the late 70s and early 80s, how very different it was at that time to think about coming out?
I write in Body Counts that most of the initial gay men I met in Washington who were so deeply closeted, as I started to, even before I was coming out, but as I started to have relationships and meet people, I really believe, you know, every single day they would have woken up more prepared to kill themselves than to have their sexual orientation publicly known. you know, it was not so long from the great purges of the 1950s and early 60s where, you know, people by the hundreds, by the thousands actually, were being fired from the State Department and government agencies for being gay or suspected of being gay, many of whom did commit suicide. So that was still very fresh in sort of the consciousness in Washington, which back then in particular was essentially still a southern city. So first, you know, getting past that, you know, idea that this was something you could live with was a big step. You know, for me, it meant giving up the political – I thought it meant giving up the political ambition I had, any, you know, hope of running for office or, you know, whatever the other ambitions associated with that might be. It also meant separating myself from – most of the friends I grew up with, you know, the people I knew in grammar school here in Iowa City and in junior high school and at the Jesuit boarding school in Wisconsin that I went to, who were, you know, afraid, disgusted, angry, you know, or just distanced themselves from me. That was very painful. And in some ways, some of that still remains painful. Particularly when I see groups of friends who I know remain good friends today, and I sort of, you know, became no longer a part of that circle after I came out. And of course, the family dynamic. You know, I knew coming out was going to hurt my parents, and to do something that you were conscious was going to hurt someone else was very difficult. And, you know, I had to come to the conclusion that I had to do this. And ultimately, my mom's no longer living, but my dad a few years ago said something really beautiful to me, one of the really most beautiful things he's ever said to me, which was that he thought that my coming out of the closet made him a better person and made our family a better family. But that's in hindsight. You know, back then, it was very difficult. It was very lonely. You know, in Body Counts, I tell the story about getting Tennessee Williams to sign the fundraising letter for the first fundraising letter for what was launching then the Human Rights Campaign Fund. And that came out of a discussion a group of us who were working on the project had, and myself and Gregory King were the two youngest people there. We were insisting that someone openly gay sign the fundraising letter. Well, the fundraising letter was going to, you know, all sorts of progressive donors to the ACLU and whatever, you know, across the country. And it needed to be somebody that had wide name recognition. There was no one. We could not come up with anyone. You know, there were a few writers. There were poets. There's Audre Lorde. There was, you know, Christopher Isherwood. But these weren't names that were widely known. And so first Gore Vidal was suggested because he written and talked about being what he considered homophile rather than homosexual. But we didn't know how to reach him. And it was rumored that he was going to run for the U.S. Senate from California in 1982, which he did. So we gave up on that. And then I thought about Tennessee Williams, who I had an acquaintance with, because while he had never like formally officially said he was gay, people assumed it. People had seen him in gay bars. You know, we knew that he was. And so that was a pretty big name, right? Our runner-up, if we couldn't get Tennessee Williams, the only other name we had of someone with such wide name recognition and any sort of authority on this issue was actually not someone who was gay. It was a talk show host, David Susskind, who had done a number of programs on homosexuality. And that just is... you know, to me, just reminds me of the paucity of any kind of role models at the time. There was no one. There was absolutely no one.
Wow. Well, I would love for you to read a little bit of the book. And this is about this time before or when you were deciding to come out and coming out to your family. Could you read us a little bit about a letter that you wrote home to your parents?
Sure. I came out to my mother at the Sanctuary, the bar here in Iowa City, one evening in the summer of 1978. A year later, in October of 1979, I went to the first National March on Washington for lesbian and gay rights. That was a transformative experience for me.
And when you came out to your mother, first of all, she asked you, right?
She asked me.
And then she asked you not to tell your father.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. And so this National March on Washington in October of 1979 was transformative for me. And it was right around the time of my parents' anniversary. So I started out writing them a note about their, you know, anniversary, which I sometimes did. And it turned into a letter about me having come out a year ago. It's been 1 year since I told you about an important part of me in my life. Mom, the night I told you, we cried as though it were the end of something. I think you foresaw a very sad future. I hope in the year that has passed you've realized for me it's not a sad thing, but a very, very happy thing. For the first time with them, I framed my sexual orientation in political terms and presented myself as part of the gay rights movement. My new boldness also came from a change in thinking about my career. I continued in the letter, if my lifestyle prevents me from running for political office or from living without scandal in Iowa City, so be it. I've accepted that. No one can ever blackmail me, and I'll know I'm helping towards the day when there won't be 15, 16, 17-year-old gay men and women committing suicide or feeling self-hatred. This was the letter that I began as a greeting card, noting their wedding anniversary, and then once I began, everything I needed to say kept spilling out of me, and I ultimately sent them a fat envelope with the card and 4 or 5 additional handwritten pages. It would be easy for us to get along for the rest of my life with your only acknowledgement of my gayness to be when you might occasionally meet a friend or lover. But I desperately want it to be more than that. The more the world I see, the prouder I am of being an Iowan, Catholic, and your son. I took a while to put this long emotional letter in the mail. I unsealed the envelope and reread what I'd written twice before taping it shut and dropping it in a mailbox. Every day I hoped to find a message on my answering machine or a letter from them. Like my gayness itself, the letter was acknowledged only when I brought it up, which I did when I called them about 10 days later. But it was not discussed. I was disappointed. 2 decades later, I found this and other letters I'd sent my parents in a folder that my father had kept with my school records. The original was accompanied in the file by a typed version my father had his secretary transcribe, carefully replacing names of famous politicians I outed with XXXXXX. When I asked him why he had it typed up, he said, "Maybe I thought it was important." Rereading the letter today, over 30 years later, I'm struck by how resolute I was about my sexual identity during a period when other aspects of my life were chaotic and unfocused. I got by but did not excel at Georgetown and was repeating that pattern at Columbia. Any foundation I had established for a traditional political career was in jeopardy because of my growing gay activism. I discovered sex and pursued it enthusiastically, but sometimes in ways that were degrading, opportunistic, or self-destructive. As a whirling dervish of activity, involved in many things, but without any structure or plan. I wanted to do something significant with my life, but I couldn't articulate what the possibilities were. Yet of the importance of LGBT liberation to my life, I had no doubt.
That's Sean Strube reading from his book, Body Counts, a memoir of politics, sex, AIDS, and survival. And I love the fact that your dad had that letter typed up. And that he knew that that was something important and would be important in the future. But it also really strikes me that you had no idea that he felt that way. Were you, after you came out to your parents, how did you feel about their response? How long did it take you to feel like they accepted it?
You know, they accepted it because it just was a reality. They didn't have a choice not to accept it. I mean, the choice was, I guess, to sort of reject me entirely, which wasn't something I ever seriously, you know, was concerned that they would do. I knew that they loved me. You know, that was in 1979, that letter. You know, another sort of difficult milestone was when I was formally diagnosed with HIV, and I told them that. You know, my father, I don't know when he would say he sort of, you know, accepted it on whatever terms, but, you know, my parents were, you know, their faith is very important to them and they prayed a lot for me. And I think that was sort of their default. That's what they knew they could do. And, you know, it just has sort of been over time. You know, I've had another sibling who's come out of the closet and other relatives and then as they became sort of more aware, you know, they started recognizing other people in their lives. And, of course, other friends of theirs who had sons or daughters who were gay. And I think inadvertently, because I was so public, you know, being as public as I've been was probably as difficult as just the fact that I was gay. You know, it's one thing to have a kid that's gay. It's another thing to have a kid come to your hometown and stand on the steps of the old Capitol at the Gay Pride March and, you know, and bellow out to the crowd what it was like growing up gay in Iowa City. But I think inadvertently, my parents became kind of, you know, go-to people for other friends of theirs who had gay and lesbian children. And they found that they actually had an expertise. They had a familiarity. They had something to share and to be helpful to these other parents that I suspect was satisfying to them.
Let's talk about how your activism developed. You were in New York City at a time when things were changing very rapidly. And you had some tremendous political skills. I mean, you talked about maybe not excelling in school, but it became clear very early on that as a fundraiser, you could really, really make a difference for a political campaign or for an organization. And in some of those cases, your sexuality would have been very problematic. So as your skills, as a fundraiser, as an organizer grew, you kind of had to make a choice, didn't you, between, again, going into that world of politics and making a real difference, or going the direction of activism and making a real difference there, but also being able to be yourself, to be authentic.
I think the choice, to the extent that it was a conscious choice, it was when I, you know, came out to my parents and peers and, you know, knew I was gay and was not going to hide that, even though I continued to hide it, you know, a little bit in professional context. But I was totally prepared for to be found out. You know, if they find out, they find out. They don't like it, they don't like it. But I do think that that was part of what moved me towards fundraising, because, you know, fundraising is so measurable. And what I think it was Jesse Unruh, that was treasurer of California, who said money is the mother's milk of politics. And so if you could generate funding, it didn't really matter anything else. I mean, they wouldn't have cared, you know, what you were. And the fundraising expertise I had was in mass marketed fundraising, was in direct mail, which didn't involve me speaking to people and asking them for money or dealing with major donors. It was about crafting a message and sending it out to, you know, tens, hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people, and raising money that way. And also, you know, the fundraiser has a voice in, you know, policymaking, whether it's, you know, in a campaign or in an issue. So that was a good way for me to kind of exert my, you know, my voice politically and, you know, support causes that I cared about.
This time was a very important time as far as gay people starting to be recognized, people starting to come out of the closet and really living in a freer way than gay people had ever before. It also coincided with the appearance of HIV. And you were in New York City and you were present for the beginning of what turned into an epidemic. And you write about the early ideas of what HIV, what AIDS was, and not just, you know, some of the things that we heard in the media, but also the things that you were talking about with your friends and your own private fears about it. There was so much that wasn't known, that nobody understood about AIDS at that time. Can you give us an idea of what it was like to be there, to be in this community and starting to see this disease emerge?
It was terrifying. And when it became terrifying, you know, varied a lot by person. You know, when the very first reports came out, you know, a lot of people thought, well, it's a handful of people. You know, it's five people. It's 43 people. You know, there are a lot of gay men in the world. It was people who, you know, were promiscuous, whatever that means. I've learned over the years that promiscuous is generally defined as anyone who has more sex than you have. But so people would find ways to distance themselves from those they felt were were getting sick. You know, in my, you know, circle, you know, there were people who were in total denial, who wouldn't talk about it, would resent it if it was brought up, you know, particularly in like a social context at a dinner party or something. And then people who were obsessing over it were so terrified. And, you know, every cough, you know, every mosquito bite, every whatever, you know, they were sure that that was the beginning of the end for them. And I'm, you know, in those very earliest days, I'm sure I sort of swung from one extreme to the other. But I was more than anything else curious. You know, I wanted to know and understand what this was about. You know, it was always political to me from the very beginning. I mean, I saw healthcare in political terms from when I was 12 or 13 years old and first exposed to activism around reproductive rights. And I knew, you know, that I had a real good sense of how little concern there was about the health of gay men by the government and others.
And I'm going to interrupt you here. We have to take a short break, and
sure.
And we will get right back to this conversation in a moment. I'm talking with Sean Stroob. His new book is Body Counts, a memoir of politics, sex, AIDS, and survival. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest this hour is Sean Stroob. He grew up in Iowa City and had a distinguished career in fundraising and activism. He founded the magazine PAWS, P-O-Z, PAWS, and it's designed to serve the community of people who are living with HIV and AIDS. This is a community he's very familiar with because he himself has been living with HIV since around 1980. And Sean, just before the break, I asked you a huge question and didn't give you nearly enough time to answer it. But we were talking about what it was like to be in this community, in the gay community, in New York City, at a time when AIDS was just beginning to emerge. And I was really struck by what you wrote about as doctors were trying to figure out what AIDS was and how it was transmitted and who it would affect. And you even personally knew a number of different doctors who had incredibly different theories about how people could get AIDS. And a lot of this was political at the time as well. This was a time when gay politics were very contentious. So how did you even try to make sense of what it was and what it meant to you?
Well, how I made sense of it was just, you know, sort of learning. I mean, you know, just immersing myself in it and listening to all sorts of different views and opinions, whether it was about causation or treatment or pathogenesis of the disease, whatever it was. You know, one of the central sort of debates was whether this was an previously undiscovered pathogen suspected as to be a virus. You know, once you were exposed to it, you were going to die, or whether it was a result of the multifactorial theory, a result of repeated assaults on one's immune system, that a lot of gay men at the time had so many sexually transmitted diseases. There was such an explosion of gay male hypersexuality in the 70s and the commercial sex establishments, the bathhouses and so on, that, you know, many gay men were getting sexually transmitted infections at a phenomenal rate and treating them quite casually. And there was a view that this was having a cumulative effect on breaking down one's immune system. You know, the reality is there was a virus discovered in 1984, but it was those behaviors of gay men that had created an incredibly efficient sort of ecosystem for transmitting pathogens. And gay men, I include myself as part of that. I don't separate myself from it at all. And to a certain extent, I sort of see the epidemic as a public health consequence of the repression that gay men had faced for so long. You cannot take any part of society and stigmatize it, criminalize it, give it fewer chances in life tell it that it is sick, define it as ill, as we were officially, all homosexuals were until 1973, and treat it so poorly without ultimately having some kind of public health consequence. So, you know, after the Stonewall riots in 1969, when a sort of new era of sexual liberation came to being, and this new sort of community was created that at its core was a sexual liberation movement where, you know, sexual communion was really synonymous with liberation. Yet at the same time, you know, many of us knew very little about our bodies, you know, virtually no health care that was specifically for gay men. When the epidemic hit, it was a real challenge because this newfound sexual freedom was incredibly important to people. And any suggestion that we were doing anything that could somehow have contributed to the epidemic or facilitated its spread was incredibly contentious. Even using the word promiscuity in that context risked being, you know, accused of being sex negative or something like that. So you had a couple of things happening. You had, you know, initially, you know, there were people saying that, oh, you know, this epidemic, it could have hit anywhere. It could have hit housewives in Westchester County or on Long Island. It just happened to strike in the gay community first. It was just a coincidence that gay men were getting, which of course was not true. Housewives in Westchester weren't having the kind of sexual venues and community that gay men had created in many places. So even the initial response from a lot of the gay community leadership and the initial AIDS organizations were unwilling to recognize this. It was so politically contentious and difficult. You know, the first safer sex materials from gay men's health crisis were focused on identifying if your partner might have AIDS. You know, it would say take a shower with your partner before having sex and check and see if he has any spots, you know, the red lesions. Condoms weren't mentioned until the seventh item on a list of 10 things you can do to reduce your risk of getting AIDS.
Now, you know now that you contracted HIV very early on in this epidemic. It took a long time for you to know that, although you suspected it long before you actually knew that. You'd had some health problems. You read an article that described three different symptoms that you had been experiencing: the weight loss, swollen lymph nodes, night sweats. But at that time, there wasn't even a test that you could take. I mean, you write about encountering other friends who were displaying signs of infection, who said, oh, we went to the doctor, we got checked out, and we're fine. And then a couple of months later, they're dead. What was going through your mind? And obviously, you didn't think about it every waking moment, but you suspected that you were infected, but you didn't know.
Right. Well, when I read the first article in the summer of 1981 that described symptoms shared by a group of gay men who had gotten sick and died, I had all three of those symptoms. Swollen lymph glands the year before. I had been at Sloan Kettering because they thought I might have had a lymphoma. My lymph glands were so, you know, grotesquely swollen, and it was this sort of mystery. The night sweats and weight loss. And I'd moved to New York. I thought, well, maybe a faster lifestyle, you know. At that age, my weight fluctuated all the time. I didn't pay much attention to it. And I just thought I sweat a lot. But when I read those three symptoms in that article, I got this feeling in the pit of my stomach that this had something to do with me. And then I soon found that lots of my friends had those same symptoms. You know, in those first few years, AIDS was people who were dying, who were very, very sick, who had no immune system left and were, you know, generally dead within weeks of their diagnosis. And I remember doctors, you know, telling me and others, the fact that you are not dying means you still have an immune system. Your body is fighting back. So we didn't necessarily see it as progressive. There's even the suggestion that because you have these mild symptoms, it means you won't get AIDS because your body is able to control the infection. So there's tremendous confusion. And, you know, and of course, the stigma and the fear, you know, literally people afraid to touch you. You know, I write in Body Counts about incidents like being at a dinner party in the village and all gay men. And one of the guys who, you know, was rumored, you know, had AIDS, you know, secretly or whatever, you know, when he used the bathroom, you know, the host kind of discreetly got up and went in and took the bath linens out and replaced them, the towels. And, you know, after the guests left, I stayed and helped clean up. And they had a separate sink of, you know, super hot water for that guest's, you know, dishes and utensils. You know, that was a part of our daily life. You know, you'd run into someone, the deaths were coming at such a rate that, you know, if I saw someone on the street I hadn't seen in a while, my first reaction was relief, they're still here. Then if we started talking and maybe we had a mutual friend I hadn't seen in a while, I'd be afraid to ask because sometimes you'd say, hey, have you seen Joe? You know, and you'd hear, oh, didn't you hear? You know, Joe died. And this was happening all the time. We were going to more funerals and memorial services than birthday parties. And you didn't even have time to grieve because you were so quickly on to the next death. You know, there were times when I would go, well, I would, you know, when I would visit someone in the hospital and there were, you know, separate AIDS wards generally, I would walk along and read the names of other patients in that wing because inevitably there'd be someone else I knew.
You ended up losing your partner to AIDS, and he hadn't even been officially diagnosed that you knew of before he became terribly, terribly ill and died shortly after. You knew you were living with HIV. And at some point, you had sort of a change of mindset, and this is the change of mindset that led to your magazine, Paws, that people were living with HIV. You had seen a lot of people dying with AIDS. But what was it that made you think, wait a minute, we're still here. I'm still here. There are other people who have to live with this disease, and I need to be doing something for them.
Well, when the test came out and I was formally diagnosed, my doctor, held my hands across his desk, and he had tears in his eyes, and he said, look, this was in 1985. He said, look, Sean, these days you can have 2 good years left. You know, that was optimistic, hopeful news. That was the best thing he thought he could tell me. And at that point, I believed that. I sold my house and I sort of made preparations to die. But at the same time, I also started just a few months later, I got involved with the People with AIDS Coalition in New York, which was a network of people with AIDS that was formed to sort of help each other and be each other's support and to create the services that we needed, whether healthcare or social support or conduct research, buyers clubs. We formed the first buyers club. So I had these kind of 2 things going. One was the, you know, what the doctor was telling me and what the media was telling me, because everything in the media was 100% fatal, dread disease, no survivors, no cure, no treatment, terminal illness. And if I listened to that, and if I listened to the healthcare establishment, I was expected to die. But then I started meeting these other people with AIDS who, yes, they were, you know, dealing with a, you know, very serious life-threatening illness, and many of them ultimately did die. But they were also, you know, falling in love and breaking up, pursuing their careers, paying their rent, raising their families, going to school, starting businesses. And many of them were engaged in advocacy and activism to help other people with AIDS. And I was so drawn to that. And these were some of the people who were leading the most vital and I would even say important lives of anyone I knew. And so I migrated towards that and became kind of an evangelist with other people who were diagnosed, saying, you know, don't believe that this necessarily means you're going to die. You have a lot of life to live. You're alive right now. Realize that. Act on that. And that's what ultimately led me to start the magazine Paws.
The world that we're living in today is very different than it was in 1980 and 1985. And you have expressed in other interviews frustration with how little young people even know about AIDS and about this time. In writing this book, in talking with people, in meeting with young people, what do you want people to know right now that you don't think is being talked about?
Well, first and foremost, the epidemic rages on. A senior epidemiologist at the Centers for Disease Control a few months ago released data that shows that of college-age gay men today, half of them will have HIV by the time they're 50 at the current rates of seroconversion. Of college-age gay men of color today, half of them will have HIV by the time they're 35 at the current rates of seroconversion. And this is sort of masked by the fact that the epidemic overall in the U.S. is largely static, but the heterosexual transmission has declined. The gay male transmission is increasing, particularly with young gay men and especially with young gay men of color. You know, we're in this look-back moment where there's all this cultural production around the epidemic, right? Exhibits and films and books. And one, you know, concern I have about a lot of that is they somehow, you know, sometimes convey that the epidemic is over. It isn't. The second is that I think that a lot of the things we did in the very beginning of the epidemic, the activism pre-ACT UP, if you will, ACT UP is the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, the very spectacular street demonstrations and street theater that I was so much a part of and I write about in the book. But that didn't start until 1987. The activism that preceded that was really the self-empowerment movement of people with AIDS themselves, largely modeled after the women's health movement in the 60s and the 70s, that was incredibly effective in all aspects of this, whether providing treatment or prevention or supporting people who are positive. And I think that a lot of those ideals, you know, that were the foundation of, you know, creating the AIDS service organizations on a peer-to-peer model, you know, supporting networks of people with HIV to empower people with HIV, the principle of engaging people with HIV meaningfully in all aspects of policymaking and service delivery, you know, that would affect their lives, that they had a right to be a part of that. Those principles early in the epidemic have largely faded away. You know, the peer-to-peer service delivery network we created has incrementally moved back towards the more traditional paradigm of benefactor-victim. The focus on empowering people with HIV has really faded away. And I think that that is the reason the stigma is increasing. I think that is one of the biggest obstacles to reducing the rate of HIV transmission. And we need to go back to what we were doing in those first years. But at the same time, in prevention, we have to recognize that the consequences of HIV are profoundly different than they were 25 years ago. You have to respond to the epidemic that is right now, not the epidemic that was. And too often, the message around the epidemic to young gay men is either, oh, it's horrible, the most awful thing, life's over, or it's no big deal, you just pop a pill and you forget about it. And the reality is somewhere in between. It is a life-changing event. You don't want to get this virus. It's a lifelong health challenge. It's expensive. It's time-consuming. It's stigmatizing beyond belief. And it complicates intimate relationships in ways one can't possibly understand unless they've gone through it. So we need to do that in a way that's also affirming their sexuality and isn't shame or fear-based.
Sean, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Sean Stroob is the author of Body Counts, a memoir of politics, sex, AIDS, and survival. He'll be speaking tonight at CSPS in Cedar Rapids at 5:30 and reading Friday night at 7 at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City. I'm Charity Nebbe. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.